Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Gab, Cody, here we are at an undisclosed location within the Pittsburgh Playhouse, and I am not going to say where. All I'm going to say is, how about this seashell lamp, huh?
Festive.
He's spared no expense.
Let's
here.
Toast to that.
Oh, indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you for being here. And cheers to your recent successes. There have been quite a bit. Theater artist and filmmaker. Does that sum it up? Does that do it justice?
I think so. I also like amateur puppetry.
Oh. How, I mean, this is my image. Is it? Do I have a career? Am I?
Okay, you just stole my one bit.
There are thieves everywhere. There. Did you copyright it?
Great steal.
Now, theater artist and filmmaker, those are two professions that, at least as far as I know, the guidance counselors in high school are not encouraging people to go towards necessarily. Mm-hmm. So why do you do what you do?
Well, because when I was in eighth grade, I did not take my guidance counselor's advice and become a scientist.
That's what they suggested for you. Mm. Now, why do you think they saw that in your cards?
Let's see, I was shy and bookish.
Well, that's awfully stereotypical for a scientist. I know some that are pretty outrageous.
I know lots of scientists, and they are more outrageous than performers or writers. I don't know why. Why do people do what they do? Brian, you tell me. I'm at a loss.
Passion usually comes up, you know? Maybe a better way to phrase it, what keeps you doing what you do?
The inability to do anything else?
That's a great answer. Because a lot of times when I sit down with an actor or an actress or even a director, I'll say, you know, if there was a worldwide theater strike that, you know, lasted indefinitely and you had to do something else, what would it be? And so many of them are without an answer to that, which I think is great, because every instructor in the theater I ever had said, if you can do something else, do it.
I think that's a good bit of advice. I keep doing it because I am passionate and curious, and I am perplexed by the world, and I'm trying to sort out the world in the work that I do. So I think that maybe being a scientist would be another way to do that. And perhaps if I could go back in time, I would be a theater artist, filmmaker, and scientist. But as it is, I think that I'm often confounded by behavior of people, of politicians, of groups of people who do things that I find to be peculiar or outlandish, and I want to figure out why they're doing what they're doing. And so the act of writing or directing or making a movie is often putting those characters into action and trying to find some sort of empathetic view of them so that I can understand the world, because it's a place I find to be oftentimes very confusing.
So as a theater artist, you are in a sense a scientist to the human condition. Through your interpretation of it.
I am an anthropologist and occasionally a biologist.
Very good. That does make sense when you put it that way. Mm. So what is the first inception of a play?
for you? Is it an idea? Is it something that comes to you inspired by a person or a character? What's the very first seed that becomes what we see on stage?
The beginning of a play or a screenplay or anything that I write is always a question, something that I'm grappling with. And that question normally leads me into a character or a series of circumstances. But as I said earlier, I'm propelled forward. I'll give an example because this might be better understood, for example. I was listening to the radio about 3 or 4 years ago, and there were some very conservative folks on the radio, and they were actually being covered at an event. They were protesting Obama, and they'd been sequestered into an area that was roped off where they were allowed to shout and hold up their billboards, and they were calling themselves the Second American Revolution. And I was so intrigued by what they were saying and by this idea that they were the Second American Revolution, that I sat down and wrote a play based on those people. I said, okay, who are these people who are so compelled and who would say of themselves that they, who represent such a small percentage of Americans, are the Second American Revolution?
That's a good question.
And so that question spurred me to write the play. Prussia 1866, I watched a series of events unfold that I found to be, they really shook up my own ideas of morality. I watched some people close to me behaving in a way that made me uncertain about what my view of their behavior was, right? You know, was I going to be judgmental? Did I just sort of allow it falling into categorically this sort of artist or Western morality? Like, what was my approach to this event? And I wondered again why the people behaved the way that they did. And so I decided to write one of them as a character. And so that happens often for me, is that I'm compelled by some need to make sense. And in writing, you recreate the world, and you can create a world that has order, even if it expands into chaos, as the universe always will. It can have some sort of order and some sort of meaning, at least for me, and I can work out some of these existential issues that I'm having.
Now, at what point in that process, then, do you say to yourself, this story belongs on the stage, or this story belongs on the screen?
Well, I think that stories that have a lot of talking and ideas in them oftentimes are better suited for the stage, because the stage is the writer's medium and film is really the director's medium. So
there are stage directors that may disagree with that.
Well, that's because they're uninformed and undereducated. So I would say that that was a glib response to the directors. What I do believe is that in theater, a director can play a strong role with a writer and with other folks. And in fact, you can even take a script that's already been written, deconstruct it, and create a piece of theater. So you're right. I do think that the act of creating and making a whole theatrical piece is much more important than the writing as literature. Like, I don't think playwriting should be literature, but I do think that theater affords you an opportunity to express ideas through language, whereas film is much more a medium of expressing ideas through images. So if I have characters who speak in heightened language and are arguing points, then this is obviously going to be something more theatrical. But if I am struck by a location or by an idea visually first, then that seems more filmic to me. And I have a few ideas for films that I'm working through. But I think it's also a struggle to move from one medium to the other. I mean, I think as a theater artist, I love language. And I think that there's a place for that in film. We don't see that or have the opportunity to see films that rely on language because of the big budget world that we live in.
It's not what's selling. It's the blockbusters, the explosions.
Right, that's a whole other conversation about what's selling, right? Because it's... Oh, that is at least an hour and a half worth of conversation about why the work in film is actually like it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people would go... I'm always, in this way, an optimist in that I believe that if you gave the audience higher quality...
Yes.
...that they would respond to that, and that you train an audience to appreciate whatever work you put before them. And, you know, right now we've trained our audience to have very low expectations and to... And I don't mean just in the theater. I mean in film. Mm-hmm. But in both, I think we're, as theater artists, we should always be tasked with training our audience to expect more from their experience at the theater.
And I have to imagine that economics does put a lot of pressure on the artist. I mean, for example, nobody's writing plays with, you know, 10 characters anymore because it's just not economically sound for the theater.
A wonderful thing about Point Park is that last year they let me devise a piece with 24 conservatory students. Wow. So we did a piece called The Alchemist Lab, and there were 24 performers, and it was a magnificent opportunity to create a piece of physical theater that would be impossible to create with a cast of five. And so I think in the university systems and with broad-minded artistic directors like Ron, Lindblom here at the Playhouse and with Point Park, that we do have the opportunity to work in those larger numbers. I think that the economic constraints on theater right now are really detrimental to the production of theater that's worth going to. And I'm not criticizing the artists, and I'm not even criticizing the institutions. I just think that we're stuck in a bit of a sort of negative feedback loop where their risk aversion causes certain choices to be made, and those choices often are anathema to the creation of real theater. You know, like what does it take to make real theater? Well, it takes a lot of time. It takes an ensemble. It takes a vision that's allowed to be created collaboratively over time with a group of artists. And those conditions, time, a group of artists together, being able to feed themselves and pay their rent, are, you know, two conditions that the American theater rarely is able to create in order to create a work. But I think those economic constraints, I think that if we raised our standards of what theater is, stopped looking at playwriting as an act of literature, but looked at it as the starting blueprint for an act of theater, that and demanded of ourselves and of the audience and of the institutions that we won't accept, you know, a two-week rehearsal process where people don't know each other, they put up a play, and then you're seeing something that is like the shadow of theater. Mm. You know, you're not really seeing something that has... And you know, we're really lucky in Pittsburgh in that the community is really we're all familiar with one another. You know, the actors all know one another, and so it's almost like one big rep company. And in that way, I think Pittsburgh has an advantage. And so that if you do a show, you oftentimes, you know, you're like, I've worked with this person, and that relationship means that you're starting from some place farther along than if you get a group of people who've never met, throw them in together, make them work really quickly to make something. So in Pittsburgh, I mean, I'm not talking about local theater, you know, again, I'm talking about like how it is in this way that we make theater in the United States. You know, we take people and we put them together. They don't know each other. They have a short period of time, and
it's bizarre when you have to think about it.
Yeah, it's not really making theater. It's like staging. It's like a really lovely staged reading.
So where do you see this? I mean, you've got an excellent perspective on the current state of affairs in American theater. Where do you see it in 10 years? Is the outlook grim or is it positive?
Well, I think I'm definitely an optimist in the sense that I know I'm going to continue working towards the, for lack of a better word, the ideals that I have for how to make theater and the ideals of what theater can be. So because I'm going to keep working towards them, I would say that my outlook is positive. I think that the ubiquity?
I'm going with it regardless.
I don't know which one it is. Of immersive theater, site-specific theater, and the way that smaller companies, more adventurous companies, companies who don't have huge structures that they have to support, are able to engage an audience and make the audience a participant, means that we could be at the, I would say we're sort of in the middle of a process that could be changing in a really positive way those expectations of what theater is. And you know, we've gone through these revolutions before. I mean, it is a cycle of the presentation of Boulevard Theater, the rejection of Boulevard Theater, the advent of a new, you know, I always think of the Open Theater and Joseph Chaykin and Peter Brook and all of those artists who came about, and then, you know, Carol Churchill, Complicité, Pig Iron right now. But I think these companies are companies that if they are allowed to survive and thrive, and if the artists who take the time to make work and raise the bar are allowed to survive and thrive, that it could be a really, really, really exciting time. And I think what's killing theater right now is that people go to the theater and they fall asleep. And it's not just because they're of a certain age. I think it's because the theater doesn't demand their attention.
Now, I want to know, if you see somebody sleeping in a theater, mm-hmm. do you confront them? Do you wake them up? What does Gab Cody do?
Brian, what have I just described? People do not sleep in their place. You know, and having said that, I think that people are so used to doing it. I will tell you the humorous story that I did a show at a really big theater in Florida, and the pre-show music would start, and sometimes we would peek out, you know, you're not allowed to do that, but we'd peek out, and people would be asleep already before the show started, which meant that for them, the act of going to the theater was an act. It was soporific before the play started. So
that's what they went to Florida for.
Yeah, right. So there's, we take no offense, right, at that, because it doesn't have anything to do with the show. You know, I think even when you do magnificent work, there will be someone who drank too much and ate a steak. So
now that might be me, but I'll be awake, damn it.
You know, when you come to see my show.
That's true.
No, I feel like one of those composers who makes the really loud music in the middle of their drawing. I'm always confused if it's Mozart or Beethoven, who's famous for that.
They both got pretty loud from
time
to time.
Yeah, that was always, yeah. I always heard that was partly because
to keep people awake.
To keep people awake, because they would be lulled into a certain sort of sensibility and the music would come.
Now, the delivery of a play from your, you know, the inner workings of your mind, your spirituality, everything that it takes to put that story together, put it on paper, and see it fleshed out on stage, that's an experience, and the emotional reward of that experience is, I think, something that only playwrights truly know. It's, there aren't a lot of other professions where you follow a course like that and see something delivered back to you, interpreted by a team of artists, directors, actors, and this is something you've experienced many times. How is that experience for you, and does it differ from production to production?
It absolutely differs from production to production. Each production is like having another child. It's painful, it's exciting, filled with exuberance, but it takes a lot of effort, and each of those children are very different from one another, all part of the same family, but very different. So I think every theater experience I've had has been unique. I try to keep for myself some common denominators. And that has to do with an approach to the work, because I come from an improvisational background. I actually come from first a classical background, because I studied at North Carolina School of the Arts in their conservatory. So I had a very traditional classical training, but that actually included a lot of non-traditional physical approaches. Mm-hmm. And I say non-traditional in the sense that right now I don't feel like people are using physical approaches towards theater as much as I wish they were. So I think that each time I approach a play, I want it to be physical theater. I don't believe in this difference between theater and physical theater. I think all theater is physical. I think I bring the background of improvisation, which is in the decades now of improv experience that I have. And I love improvisation, and I love bringing both the spirit of improvisation into the ensemble. So working together with the ensemble, literally doing warm-ups, doing exercises, working together. And then also bringing that spirit of play into the work, which I think is really vital, and which is the difference between a work which is alive and one that is not. So in that way, there are things that I always bring into a production. And in another way, each production is different depending on the director and the constraints. The immersive work is very different than putting on a traditional play in a theater. So I think I answered that question.
Oh, yes. So picture it. Prussia, mm-hmm. 1866. Mm-hmm. This is your most recent work that is playing here at Pittsburgh Playhouse through February 22nd. And we're at a very interesting time in the production right now. Because I think officially opening night is...
Tomorrow
night.
So we're in previews.
And have you been...
This is why I have the curls.
Oh, was that tension that made it curl?
These are not for you. Thank you for that. No, it was the relaxation. Normally,
there's
much time.
Very good.
No, they're for the show tonight. Yeah, so we're on preview.
How are you feeling right now?
I am so looking forward to doing the play in front of an audience, because a comedy, as anyone who's ever done a comedy will tell you, is a dialogue between you and the audience. So we've been having a monologue as the cast, and so we're looking forward to having a conversation with the audience. You know, in my dream world, we would preview for 3 weeks and then open, because comedies have to be modulated with that conversation with the audience. But as it is, I'm excited and delighted and so grateful that this production is happening. The costumes are fantastic. The set is beautiful. The actors in the ensemble are hilarious and wonderful, and we're all having a great time. So. I'm excited, and I'm really also curious. I'm really curious to see how it plays over the next couple of days, because it's a world premiere, mm-hmm. and it's never been performed in front of an audience. So I'm filled with a lot of scientific curiosity.
There's that scientist again. See, that guidance counselor wasn't completely off base, you know? So we can expect, certainly, a farce is how it has been described, and a period farce, we get that from the title, and there's a familiar name in this play, Nietzsche, the philosopher. So what brought you to that character and putting him on stage?
Well, I was struck by, I was reading something about him, and he had proto-feminist friends. Mm. And I was struck by it was a confluence, a convergence of many ideas at the same time, which is often, again, probably if you talk to any writer, they'll say the same thing, but... it was the idea of Nietzsche, and the fact that he was such a taboo-busting philosopher who some people say was the first existentialist, although the French claim that they invented existentialism, so we won't get into that. But he bust busted all of the taboos about morality and religion. And farce's construction is taboo busting. Like the premise of farce is that it's a very violent act of comedy in which taboos are broken. Normally other things are broken on stage. It is one of the most violent and aggressive forms. And he, you know, will to power, self-actualizing, is one of those people. And I love the idea of Prussia because it doesn't exist anymore. And so it's almost a fantasy location. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a real place for hundreds of years, but it's, no one really knows what it is. It's almost like a magical location in which a farce could be set. And the fact that he had proto-feminist friends was really inspiring to me because in thinking about morality, I was thinking a lot about what passions drive people, and thinking about putting characters together who had opposing driving passions. Mm-hmm. And that conflict is what causes, you know, a lot of the chaos, the comedy and the chaos and the fricative... Oh, I can't say those words. There were a lot of bad words that I just took out of that sentence for you.
Oh.
Pre-edited.
Well, on my account, please. I mean, I'm sure I've heard them.
No, never.
Now, have I been pronouncing it wrong? Nietzsche? Nietzsche?
Well, I think that it is Nietzsche, but I also think that lots of people say Nietzsche. And it's a German name. So I'm sure that you and I can start a poll and probably find people on both sides of the question.
So what do you wish for the observers of this play to walk away with after having seen it?
I wish for them to walk away with a wonderful conversation starter that takes them into the night and to a restaurant where they sit around and argue and debate about life and love and theater and talk about how much they laughed and how they haven't laughed that long and hard in a long time. And you know, I also like joie de vivre, so I definitely want people to go away with a sense of joie de vivre and to be stimulated and agitated and you know, driven into a place that they weren't when they went to the theater.
And Lord help them if they fall asleep, which they will not.
Brian, you can come to the theater. We'll give you a special costume, and we'll give you a little zapper.
I would love that.
Okay, it's a deal. I can get you in.
Candy wrappers get to me, too.
They do?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I always think that you're in a play, and you're in a theater, and I am not a big fan of theater that asks us to pretend that that's not happening. So I think this play is definitely much more traditional than other theater that I've done in that it doesn't break the fourth wall, really. But I feel like I'm always in an act of breaking the fourth wall and always saying the audience is actually here. If you want to eat a hoagie, you eat a hoagie. I can't be responsible for what will happen while you're eating the hoagie. But go ahead. You know, because I love naturalism in the sense that naturalism has a place in certain writing. You know, certain plays really are most effectively realized if they're staged in a naturalistic style. But I am most interested in styles that are outside of naturalism and in styles that recognize that you're in a theater and that the audience is there and that they are an active participant in the work. And I think that that's one of the reasons why comedy is so appealing to me, because comedy is a dialogue and it's a participatory act to go to a comedy.
In one sentence.
Oh, God bless you.
Do you think you could describe your style as a theatrical artist? Now it can be a long sentence. Two
I think my style of theater and my approach to theater is a highly physicalized, highly stylized, linguistically challenging work that has a lot of spontaneity and that requires participation from the audience.
Nicely done. And I'm sure that we will see all of that in Prussia, 1866.
Indubitably.
Playing at Pittsburgh Playhouse through February 22nd. Yeah. Cheers to you and all that you do. And have a wonderful show.
Thank you.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvivant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvivant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.